I'm Willow Belden, and you're listening to Out There, the podcast that explores big questions through intimate stories in the outdoors. If you're listening to this podcast, chances are you've thought a fair bit about equality. Whether that's equality between men and women, rich and poor, gay and straight, whatever. We spend a lot of time thinking about different segments of society, about who gets what, who has power, who's in charge. And many of us spend a huge amount of energy trying to make things more equal. But what does it mean for a society to be truly equal? What would that actually look like? Could we do it? And would we actually want to live that way? Last summer, producer Katrin Redfern traveled from Brooklyn to Tanzania to look for answers. Now, Tanzania might not be the first place that comes to mind when you think about equality, but the country is actually home to one of the few truly egalitarian societies on the planet. I'll let Katrin take it from here.
The sun is just beginning its burning journey across the sky, and we're on the hunt for honey. Koyabi and Benja are whistling for someone to lead the way. There's a response from above. A small brown bird swoops down to land it on an acacia tree, chattering a hello and fanning out its feathers. The bird is called Tikiliko, the honey guide. It flies a short distance ahead and lands again, waiting for us to catch up. We follow its song and undulating flight to a baobab tree where it lands in the crook of a branch next to an African killer beehive. This bird, the honey guide, has developed a fascinating symbiotic relationship with the local people. It leads humans to honey, which is an important food source, and in return, the bird has access to wax and larvae, its own food. Benja smokes out the hive with a burning piece of brush to pacify the bees. Then he's able to reach in and pull out the golden honeycomb. The honey guide bird is rewarded with the leftovers. For me, this co-evolved relationship between species is amazing to witness. For Benja's people, a tribe called the Hadzabe, it's just the start of a normal day on the edge of the Serengeti Plains. My journey to meet the Hadza began in Arusha, a bustling city in northern Tanzania. It was the start of my honeymoon, and my jet-lagged new husband and I were picked up in a huge ancient jeep by Daudi, a Maasai warrior with a degree in ecology. He would be our interpreter and guide. We drove a few hours south on a paved road, and then for many more off-road, bouncing along with the shock squeaking violently. "We call this an African massage," Daudi shouted. In some ways, the journey started years before, in my teens, when I began wondering how it was that some people had a lot and some people had a lot less, and our society thought that was okay, even normal. It was around the same time that I began noticing that being born a girl meant I was taken less seriously by the world than the boys were. Girls were expected to please and play a supporting role, while the boys were the doers. We were their audience at basketball games and band practice, but they didn't return the favor. What boys were into was important, but girly things were silly, seemed to be the message. How did this come about? I wanted answers to these questions. So instead of going to a prestigious college and pursuing a secure career path, I left high school with a GED. I took to studying political theory, anthropology, and ecology in places where people enthusiastically identified as anarchists. I did eventually end up back in formal education, completing 2 master's degrees in the UK. But what really excited me during that time wasn't the degree classes. It was the radical anthropology group I went to in the evenings. The group drew from different academic disciplines to connect the dots, rather than sticking to one small patch of intellectual ground. And rather than just studying cultural traits, almost as trivia, the random characteristics of this or that tribe, like butterfly collecting, which is what much of anthropology does these days, the group wasn't afraid of putting the pieces together to create grand unifying theory. The main focus was on egalitarian cultures, societies where everyone is equal. So I know what you're thinking. You're saying, yeah, that sounds nice, but do societies like that really exist? Are there any places where everyone is truly equal? And it's a fair question. You're right. There are very few egalitarian cultures today. But this wasn't always the case. Back in the day, like 12,000 years ago, before the agricultural revolution, many cultures existed where everyone was equal. And those were the communities we studied in our radical anthropology group. We paid special attention to the social strategies that functioned as leveling mechanisms. In other words, the social, political, and material factors that intentionally discourage hierarchy in a society. I was fascinated by these strategies. I wanted to understand how you can organize a society to be truly egalitarian, no haves and have-nots, where women and men are considered equal. I wanted to know when in our history societies like this had existed. I was sure another world was possible. And so, I talked my fiancé Andrew into going to Tanzania for our honeymoon to visit one of the most egalitarian societies on Earth. If you live in the West, you've probably spent lots of time learning about the advances that so-called progressive societies have made in terms of racial equality, women's rights, and religious freedoms. But it turns out that the people who live with the greatest level of equality are not part of a modernized Western society. In fact, just the opposite. They are hunter-gatherer tribes like the Hadza. And so, the day after our wedding in Italy, Andrew and I journeyed deep into one of the most iconic landscapes in the world to meet them. As we drove through dried-up riverbeds, with dust coming in the windows and our kitchen supplies rattling on the roof, Dowdy told us something of the people we were going to meet. There are 1,300 or so Hadza left, a few hundred of them continuing to live a lifestyle unchanged for tens of thousands of years. Until the birth of agriculture, the Hadza lifestyle was the norm for all humans. So for 99% of our time on Earth, this is how we lived, as nomadic hunters and gatherers. To put that in perspective, if you imagine human existence as a 24-hour clock, our species took to labor-intensive agriculture at 11:54 p.m. So what might a way of life that's been sustainable for so long have to teach our culture? We stopped to watch a small herd of elephants grazing by the side of the road. 2 little ones wrestled with their trunks and an adult stripped bark from a tree. Dowdy continued, "The Hadza grow no crops and have no domesticated animals. And most interesting to me, their social structure has no hierarchy. There are no leaders and no elites. Everyone is equal, regardless of gender, age, or ability. Everyone." Dusk was drawing in as we finally arrived at our campsite, where a few Hadza were waiting to meet us. Mubaya, they greeted us. Welcome. And we shook hands. Mutana, we said, having learnt the Hadzane word from Dowdy. Thank you. Thank you for having us crazy mutants out to visit you. Nearby, a fire burned. Several women were sitting around with the remnants of their evening meal, the empty shell of a leopard tortoise. We set up our tent and solar shower among some trees. Two Hudson men carried our luggage to the tent, and I was embarrassed by the size of our bags. How to explain we'd just come from our wedding, which in our culture necessitated fancy, heavy clothes, clothes that we'll never wear again, and high heels, and of course, a can of hairspray. But they just smiled at our sheepish mutanas and ambled away. After dinner, with Lake Ayasi shimmering like mercury in the distance, we sit around the fire to discuss plans for tomorrow. Dowdy translates. I say that we're honored to be here with people whose way of life is valued, studied, and discussed oceans away. I clumsily try to explain how much it means to visit them in person, these last few on the planet living as our ancestors did, when most of humanity has long since forgotten the old ways. I feel suddenly emotional and silly, but they nod seriously, and there is another round of mutanas. I ask what allows them to continue their traditions when so many haven't. A serious-looking young woman speaks up. Out here, we're free, whereas in town, everything costs money, she says. Even to have a pee, you need money. The others laugh. In the bush, they know how to provide a good life for themselves, but in a money system, they're powerless. Why would we want that life, says an older woman, wrapped in colorful blankets and beads. So we have to work just to eat rice and spaghetti? This brings another round of laughter. They have a beautiful life, Dowdy says, and they know it. But as soon as you bring them into civilization, they're at the bottom of the pile and everybody preys on them. I remember the comments made by other tribes we met on the way to Arusha when we mentioned the Hadza, that they were inbred, homeless wanderers decimating the wildlife, a hopeless people who couldn't settle down, the poorest of the poor. But what's wrong with being cash poor when you don't rely on money? I ask why they don't farm or keep cattle as the neighboring tribes do. The response is vociferous. When you farm, you rely on only the crops you can plant or the animals you can feed. If your crops fail or your herd dies, you starve. Not so with hunting and gathering. There have been several attempts to force the Hadza to farm, even having them escorted to fancy new villages. But they return to the bush. Why start the hard labor of farming when nature grows your food for you? When it's time for bed, we sleepily say our goodnights, being warned to watch out for scorpions in our tent. I briefly long for a hot shower and some better light than my flashlight while I take my contacts out. What do the Hadza do about bad eyesight? We lie in our narrow cots listening to a hyena close by. The next morning, we set out as a group, picking our way between the rocks and thorn bush in the morning sun. We're a colorful crew, the Hadza in their bright wraps and beaded headbands, sandals made from old tires. Benja, a charismatic young man with a distinctive low voice, is leading the way. He has longer hair than the other men, a knife on his hip in a sheath made of animal hide, and a bright blue tight sleeveless t-shirt that highlights his muscles. I ask him if he knows that the word across the front, Arsenal, refers to an English football team. He shakes his head. His belt buckle is emblazoned with a portrait of Obama. I point and ask, Obama? But he just looks at me. Either he thinks it's self-evident, or maybe the word means nothing. After all, none of the Hadza around the fire last night had heard of New York City. We continue along a faint trail past massive baobab trees, each one as thick and tall as a bridge piling. One of the women stops to point to a vine going into the ground. This is a sign of the tubers growing, which are a staple of the Hadza diet. With sharpened sticks, they tap the earth to locate the tubers, and we begin to dig for our lunch. We make a fire, and a few minutes later, we're feasting on succulent roasted tubers, like sweet potatoes.
Oh,
This simple act, I realize, is important. The fact that the Hadza dig up their lunch every day and eat it right away is a big clue as to why their culture has such an astonishing level of equality. Because it's not like being a hunter-gatherer society automatically guarantees equality. The Hadza are what anthropologists call an immediate return society. They go out each and every day to procure what they need to live. No more, no less, just what they need. So they don't do what we do. They don't create a surplus and then a system to guard it, store it, figure out who gets what amount of it. Stay with me here because this is important. In immediate return societies, people obtain a more or less immediate return from the work that they do. In delayed return societies, such as what we have in the US, labor is applied over time. And when people invest their work over months or generations into getting what they need or want, farming, raising livestock, building large structures, creating and storing a surplus, that's when hierarchy develops. People feel they've put in more work than others or should have a right to control who gets what, and it gets messy. In an immediate return society, it's kept simple. People don't attach all that stuff to their work. Everyone is entitled to what they need. No more, no less. As we eat lunch, I ask the women about gender relations. The women tell me equality is possible because they and the men know that the tribe relies on women's work. The Hadza say they're a society of hunters sustained by gatherers. Women and men do different types of work, but they're equally important, and both they and the men know it. I find the division of labor between genders uncomfortable in some ways. After all, separate but equal has proven a problematic concept in our society. Modern feminism has largely focused on women having equal access to jobs outside the home, but I can see that in our understandable desire to want an equal chance to be doctors, academics, CEOs, or just wage slaves, it's been hard to keep focus on the importance of women's traditional work, which keeps the whole thing going. This is true for hunter-gatherers as well. Women provide most of the calories for the tribe through foraging and gathering. So much for early man, the hunter. A lot of the women's strength and bargaining power comes from seeing themselves as a group with common interests, a sisterhood. I wish I could experience that solidarity on a daily basis. After the meal, we head to the Hadza camp. It's a collection of round huts made from tree branches, bent over and covered with grass, kind of like upside down bird's nests. Outside, a group of women are smoking pipes around a fire, talking and laughing. It's still the middle of the day, a time when most of us would be hard at work in the office. But here, everyone seems relaxed, unhurried. I realize it's true what I've heard, that hunter-gatherers enjoy much more leisure time than we do. Anthropologists estimate they work about 4 hours a day. The rest is spent relaxing. The Hadza have no words for days of the week or months. I think how nice it would be to live in a long now, to enjoy the present without constant planning for the next hour ahead, the next day, the next weekend. Daddy tells us he's never been with happier people. They don't worry about what happened yesterday or what might happen tomorrow, he says. Watching them, I feel like they exist inside each passing moment in a way that I can't. They are living in the moment, the way we so often failed to do. My husband and I spend a week with the Hadza. We eat with them, go hunting with them, visit their homes, relax with them by the fire. And just as I'd hoped, we learn about the forces that keep their society so equal. They don't amass physical possessions like we do, so there's nothing to covet from someone else. They don't let hunters divide up their own meat. Someone else does it to make sure everyone gets what they need. And speaking of getting what they need, everyone is allowed to demand a share of whatever there is to be had. If a zebra or a giraffe is killed, everyone gets some. No one can be turned away. Plus, everyone contributes to procuring food, even 8-year-old kids. So nobody develops too strong a dependency on others. And finally, there are the norms around living situations. Among the Hadza, social groupings are flexible and changing. If things aren't working well, anyone can move to a different camp. This goes for couples, for parents and children, for conflict between people in general. Their equality isn't a passive thing maintained by leaders. The Hadza fiercely, actively guard their egalitarianism. After a long day of hunting, where everyone came up empty-handed, we sit silently with our hosts on a small hill. I take a pack of gum from my backpack and offer it to our guides. They turn it over, uncomprehending. I mimic chewing, but not swallowing. They each take a piece and chew, watching me until I spit mine into the wrapper, and then they do the same. I feel guilty because I know the gum contains artificial sweeteners, but I want to offer something. Benja gets up and comes back with a baobab pod and gives us some of the fruit to chew, bush chewing gum. We smile at each other and look down over a land unscarred by human hands. Lake Ayasi is sparkling in the distance, the Great Rift Valley beyond. It's a scene unchanged since man first walked upright on the earth. On our way back to camp, one of the Hadza points out a tiny beehive. We dig into the honey. I look at him. He knows everything there is to know about the bush and virtually nothing of the land beyond. I wonder, is it better to know a lot about the world but often feel confused and overwhelmed? Or to know only your own traditions but feel at home in the world? As our stay with the Hadza comes to an end, I try to make sense of everything I've seen and learned. I've come to understand how a society can be equal. But what does that mean for me, for my society? Would I actually be happy to live like the Hadza? It's tempting to leave the constant demands of modern life behind. The bills, the cell phone continually ruining the moment, the email box that can't be left for a day. The Hadza have never used the internet. They told me they have no idea what it is. They don't use money. They don't know the frustration of trying to log into their bank account, having to answer security questions about what they had for breakfast on this morning 8 years ago, entering passwords for everything, long phone calls with customer service to get their gadgets to work. And more than the sense of powerlessness that these day-to-day experiences add up to, they don't have the existential problems we have, the violence we see acted out regularly because people don't feel they matter, the collective anxiety as we wonder, what's it all about? It's clear to them what it's all about. They have the stories they've been passing on for literally thousands of years to root them in belonging. Stories that were once our stories, or similar ones. They're not striving, just living. And because of that, they have this very fundamental sense that everything is okay. And yet, could I really live like the Hadza? Could I function in a society with no books, no media, no electricity, no Western medicine, no sushi? And wouldn't I miss flitting between different perspectives on the world? I couldn't live here for long without wanting all those things back. But the sense of being considered equal, regardless of what I did, not needing to succeed at anything specific to matter, it being enough just to be, would give me a sense of belonging I don't think my culture knows. We spend the last night singing and dancing. Around the campfire, I ask the Hadza if they have any advice for my culture, whose social fabric seems to be unraveling. We can't go back to living as they do. We've lost the knowledge of how to live off the land, and our wants now necessitate ever more complex resource extraction, infrastructure, products, and specialized information. Nor does a future seem certain with all kinds of global problems looming. So what can we do? The Hadza confer. Then they tell me that it's best if my culture doesn't try to move backward or forward, but stays where we are. I'm not sure if they mean this in a be here now kind of way, urging us to find the wisdom that comes from being present in the moment, or if they mean we should stop all our frenetic movement and sit down as we are until we figure out where we went wrong. Either way, I see a certain logic to it. As we trundle out of camp the next morning, I see Benja distributing a stick of gum to each person from a pack I guiltily gave him as we hug goodbye. I won't be able to email them, call them, even send them letters. How will they know how often I look up at the Brooklyn sky and think, somewhere out there, the same sun is shining down on a Hadza hunter, glinting off his bundle of arrows. The same moon rises over a Hadza fire where children are being told stories. There is dancing and singing around the fire, and someone is wearing my husband's t-shirt that says Brooklyn in green letters. I hope this world remains big enough and diverse enough to hold both of these very different places. As I sit in the plane on my way home, I think about the Hadza's advice. Don't try to move backward or forward, just stay where you are. It's comforting in a way. Stop feeling pressured to go, go, go. Stop thrashing around trying to make progress. Slow down and just be.
That was Brooklyn-based journalist Katrin Redfern. She's reported internationally on human rights, anti-trafficking, and corruption, and she's written for the BBC, the Daily Beast, and the Huffington Post, among others. For those of you who live in New York, there's going to be an exhibit about the Hadza in Newburgh starting March 25th. It's a multimedia exhibit showcasing daily life and culture for the Hadza. So if you live in the area, stop by and check it out. Coming up next time on Out There.
David used to say, what makes you think that when you dream, you're not like tuning into another channel? Like a radio, what makes you think that your dreams all originate inside your head? And I'm sure if you asked any person, have you ever dreamt of a really, really vivid place that you totally believe looked really real, but you've just never been there? I think the average person would say yes. What if you time traveled? Or what if you accessed some psyche that's outside of your own? Aldous Huxley called it the universal mind. Jung called it the collective unconscious. It doesn't have to be God, but there's some mental entity outside of your mental entity that you have occasionally an ability to channel into.
That story is coming up on April 6th. Before you go, I have a favor to ask. Out There is on a shoestring budget, less than a shoestring budget, really. If you had a chance to check out the behind-the-scenes video we posted on our blog last week, you know that our recording studio is in a closet, like literally in a closet in my house. I have to take my vacuum cleaner out in order to make space to sit, and there's not even a desk in there. Every penny of listener donations goes toward paying the freelancers who produce the stories you hear on this show. And we can't afford to pay them nearly as much as they deserve. So if you enjoy Out There and you're in a financial position to do so, please consider making a contribution to the show. It doesn't have to be big. Any amount helps. Just go to outthereshow.com and click support. Also, we have Out There t-shirts and hoodies for sale. When you buy one, you're helping us get one step closer to paying our freelancers what they deserve. Just go to outthereshow.com and click on the merch tab. A big thank you to several listeners who have already made contributions to the show. Kathy Sweetser, Walter Mugden, Carrie Gulvin, and Deb and Vince Garcia all made donations. Again, if you're able, please join them. And regardless of your financial situation, there's something all of you can do to help us out. You may have heard about a campaign that's going on for the month of March called Tripod, That's try as in T-R-Y. The goal is to introduce more people to podcasts, whether that's telling someone about a podcast you think they'd like, or showing someone how to listen to a podcast if they don't know how. So help us spread the love. Tell your friends and family and colleagues about Out There. Show them how they can listen. And if you're on social media, give us a mention with the hashtag tripod. Again, that's T-R-Y-P-O-D. That's it for this episode. Our marketing and business development director is Alex Egerking, and our theme music was written by Jared Arnold. Have a beautiful day, be bold, go outside, and find your dreams.